Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
You're listening to New Books in Geography, a podcast channel in the New Books Network. I'm your host for today, Stentor Danielson, from the Department of Geography, Geology, and the Environment at Slippery Rock University. Today, I'll be talking to Inge John, author of Cities in the Anthropocene, New Ecology and Urban Politics, published this year by Pluto Press. Dr. John, welcome to the show.
Hi, Stentor. Thank you so much for inviting me.
So to start off, why don't you tell our listeners a bit about your background and how you came to write this book?
Yes, my name is Inge, and I work as a lecturer in international urban politics at the University of Maryland and Maryland Center for Cities in the land of Wurundjeri people. My work centers around how to understand politics in a more performative sense, so how new identities and initiatives can emerge amidst of or despite of the existence or plurality of different groups and desires in cities. I mostly work on urban environmentalism and disaster planning, or more conceptually, what it means to plan in or plan for the uncertainties or complexities of contemporary urban life. I came to write this book for mainly two reasons. I think the new ecology or more than human ideas have been around for a long time, but I haven't really seen them directly being applied to urban planning context, except for the works of Robert Beauregard at Columbia or Nujan Mars at Warwick. So I think I wanted to extend their work through talking with planning practitioners in different cities. And secondly, I think I always struggled with the idea of what it means, what local really means, because I think a lot of academic literature talk about local social entities as kind of like puppets of larger systems that are already knowable behind our desk. But I think there is I think this kind of approach of, you know, something that is already knowable behind our desk is a continuation of kind of the Western tradition. So I think I was more on the side of the situated understanding of the world, in the sense that I believe in the unknowability of how every single individual interacts with their situated environments and reinvent their own realities through movement and action. So within the belief of heterogeneous and ever-evolving ontologies, there's a possibility of what we call chance of space as proposed by Doreen Massey.
Okay, well, you've just kind of set up some of my next few questions that I wanted to ask there. So let's start off with this concept of new ecology that's in, you know, the subtitle, and you just mentioned it. And so since there have been a lot of different ideas or concepts of ecology over the years, could you tell us what the specific type of new ecology that you're drawing on in this book is, and, you know, what are some of the major claims made in this new ecology that you think are really important?
Yeah. Yes. As you mentioned before, this new more than humanism has been proposed by many people, notably Bridotti, and Anna Ching and Jane Bennett. For me, I think I learned a lot from Bruno Latour and Anna Ching, Jane Bennett, and John Dewey. What I like about it is that it really questions the essentialist division between human or non-human or culture or nature. because it highlights how we are intricately intertwined with one another through co-evolution processes. So new ecology really asks us about the question of responsibility as a situated and grounded practice, so not as a top-down or universe or norm that we have to accept without question. What's really useful for me is that how new ecology helps us pay attention to our everyday or immediate surroundings. So the pro-environmental actions that we do in urban setting should be fueled by and not disconnected from our everyday experiences, you know, including water, sewer, electricity, or disaster planning, or all the kind of immediate goods that we want to value in cities. This has to be connected with what we normally perceive as pro-environmental initiatives.
Yeah, and I think one of the interesting things you do is then you take this approach to ecology, which, you know, has this aura of being really kind of radical and cutting edge. You know, when you think of many of the people that are citing some of these same, you know, theorists like Latour and so forth that you mentioned. So you take this, and for you, it leads into a very pragmatic approach to environmental politics, and that it's kind of a way to engage people who wouldn't be interested in policies that get labeled, you know, green or environmental. So can you tell us a bit about how this connection works between this new ecology and this approach to politics that kind of gets around some of the existing conflicts about things that, you know, come with that environmental label on them?
Yeah, I think I'm going on a very colloquial note here. I think what's really interesting for me to visit kinds of politically conservative cities was that they have to deal with the consequences of climate change or climate crisis. But because of their political climate, they have to invent new narratives or kinds of narratives that link the immediate socioeconomic needs with more longer term reflected social good. So I found it really interesting how they use, you know, purposefully not really using the word the environment or nature, and they use kind of wording such as, you know, low impact development, on-site stormwater management, flood buffer, riverside parks, native plants or landscaping, all of these things that people can sense in everyday life. And they connect that, they use the supposedly this kind of neutrality of material things that we find in cities as a way to advance environmental agenda. And sometimes they don't even really mention to the people they communicate with, like their ulterior motive is the environmentalism. It's more about, you know, how we live, how we are going to live together. And it's not kind of, I'm going to impose my ideas on you, but it's more like persuasion of these kind of things are really, you know, makes you feel good. So maybe this is something that you want to reflect on. And in the end, I think this kind of cultural or atmospheric approach to environmentalism can be a source of more political possibility.
Yeah, there's a really interesting, I think, material dimension to what you're talking about here in terms of the, you know, the types of politics that you're describing, but then also in the kind of roots of why we need to do this anyway. Because as you said, you're talking about cities that are in very conservative regions, and you point out that that's not just like they have this ideology of conservatism, that has like a real material basis, because these are things like, you know, you're writing about Tulsa, Oklahoma. The big industry everywhere around there is oil and gas. And so people's like actual jobs are dependent on a thing that's also tied up in causing all of the climate change problems. And then, so it's like a material cause of the conflict, but then you're looking to material objects as a way to create the solutions and get around the political conflict. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, I think it's a fair summary. And also, you know, the book is kind of the propositional note. So some of the things that I don't talk about, I think, like, you know, I forgot to talk, not forgot, but probably, you know, I try not to emphasize too much, is this, so in environmentalism, like environment movements in those regions, there are more assertive movements. Of course, you know, there are movements that are against oil and gas or fossil fuel industries because they are the drivers. And then there are movements that are pragmatic, you know, that the things that I just described to you about how they're using kind of common sense logic to introduce pro-environmentalist imageries. And so for me, it's not really the question of whether I take one side or the other, but it's really what was interesting to me was that how people try to interject what they believe to be true or what they believe to be a right thing to do, sometimes assertive way, but sometimes in a way that is more collegial, or it's not even the word that I think of, I don't know, really like creative and sometimes unexpected. And so the people who receive this kind of imageries, they don't really even know what they're getting into. But eventually what happens is the kinds of outcomes that are climate conscious.
Okay, so I mentioned there in my last question, one of your case studies, which is Tulsa, Oklahoma. And then you also talk about Darwin in the Northern Territory of Australia, Cleveland, Ohio, and Cape Town in South Africa. So how did you go about choosing those four cities as the ones that you are going to focus your research on? What did those specific cities illustrate for us?
Yeah, so for Tulsa, it's the case where I learned from disaster management and hazard mitigation. So my key research interest before this book was a lot of disaster planning. And I was reading articles of Goshak. It's kind of the core reading. And he was kind of talking about Tulsa, Oklahoma as the exemplary model for developing spatial form that is disaster resilient. For me, that was kind of interesting because it's kind of the examples that we frequently encounter. You know, we often talk about big coastal cities or the cities that we know of. But this is cities that I haven't really, you know much about. And I just thought that it was interesting, so I was kind of digging up more information, and I ran into an article that talks about how Tulsa is preparing for climate change, but in a way that is quite different. You know, just really try to emphasize on the extreme climate events and how that affects everyday lives of people, and that really becomes a source of advocating for climate conscious planning. And so I found it interesting, and I tried to have more of a comparative, international comparative angle. Darwin came into my mind because it's kind of one of the least, you know, so-called developed area because of the harsh climate. And it is also dependent on natural gas industries. And there were a lot of political contentions around whether because Darwin, that region recently received a big funding from the federal government, and there was speculation that the reason they received the federal government funding was that they allow the fracking. And so I thought that maybe I would go there and try to understand what environmentalists or environmental activists think of this issue and how they campaign for their ideals. And we can talk about that a little bit more later. As for Cleveland and Cape Town, Cleveland, I was really interested in it because of the main question of my book is that, you know, how do you introduce environmental agendas in the context where it's not sometimes always obvious? For me, I found that this kind of spatial segregation in that very evident in that area, and also the vacant land problems that are occurring was a good example for me to understand what it's like to, you know, pursue climate conscious planning. And as for Cape Town, it's also kind of similar lands, but like, you know, like try to understand more transnational and comparison, try to initiate more transnational comparison, that I thought that maybe I could compare another city in another context, and compare that with Cleveland. And obviously, you know, Cape Town is really suffers a lot from spatial segregation because of its historic uniqueness. And I was thinking of, you know, how do I go about this as a visitor? And I decided that, okay, I would talk to the, you know, experts, what I would think is experts, in the sense that, you know, the planners and environment activists and the people who are already working in that region, and how they, you know, their narratives and write about it according to their narratives. And so I think that's how I came up with the cases. But it was, you know, but I want to mention that it's kind of a random process. It really started from Tulsa and then Darwin. And then I was kind of looking for other cases where other cases that haven't really been covered in the mainstream academic literature, because I think whenever I read research articles, I read a lot about New York. I read a lot about I don't know, big coastal cities in general, but I haven't really encountered a lot of writings on those cities. And obviously, you know, Cape Town has been researched a lot by University of Cape Town, and there are really big, you know, awesome initiatives there. But for me, it's just like putting different cities into the transnational comparative lens was something that I thought I could do as a transnational person. So I think that was the main motivation there. Yeah. I don't know if I'm too, I don't know.
I'm sorry. No, that's, yeah. That's good. And, you know, I think you're illustrating the eternal dilemma of case study research, which is, you know, every different case you could pick could show us something interesting and unique. So how do you narrow it down to the specific ones that you choose? And, you know, sometimes you can be real systematic about it, but most of the time, you know, there's a certain amount of inspiration that, you know, goes into deciding, all right, these are the cities that I'm going to write about, or, you know, whatever the cases are that you're looking at.
I think the inspiration is a really good point. I mean, for me, I think I was really inspired by a lot of researchers and writers in University of Cape Town, and they talk about this electricity, water, sewer, and try to connect that with citywide region resilience. So for me, I was really just inspired by their work, and therefore I decided to compare it with other, you know, cities, etc. So I think that the writers that I admire, the things that I just, you know, come across randomly or suddenly really affect how I choose the cases.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yep. Yeah. And I think it's, you know, as important what you get out of the cases than just, you know, if you picked the right cases in the beginning, right? Okay. So I want to now circle back around to something that you mentioned in you know, your first answer, which is that you're using this ethical perspective that's really bottom up. So you're kind of getting away from having these overarching rules or definitions of the good or something that people then would, you know, conform to, that would tell us what to do, like you'd have if you had, like, you know, utilitarianism or Kantian ethics or something that give this kind of, you know, big picture universal set of rules for what we should do. So you're making an argument that we can sort of root things in our concrete everyday experiences that we have in the world. And so, you know, I'd like you to talk a little bit about that. And then also, you know, sort of my question about it is, how do we go from something that, you know, is very concrete and maybe very personal to some sort of a plan of action at the level of, you know, citywide policy or something like that? How do we make the connection between those experiences that our ethical perspective might be rooted in to, you know, changing a city law or, you know, whatever the policy outcome might be?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. And, you know, it's really the question, I think, for any social science research. How do we go about from the situated perspective to more reflected social perspective? And for me, what I want to emphasize is that probably, I really hope that it comes across, but I don't know, I really wanted to emphasize the performative power of narratives and how we tell stories and how we make different kinds of articulations. And as I mentioned before, I really, you know, when we do case study research, I'm not really the expert of all cities. You know, it's impossible. I haven't really lived there for, you know, one or two years. And, you know, sometimes it's a choice for me to go to these places and talk to different practitioners and how they answer these questions through their practice. So this was something that I was really interested in, you know, how they do certain kinds of things that they think they want to do and the questions that I want to ask academically or philosophically. And so by focusing on their narratives, the kinds of things that they do, was for me is the possibility of linking the immediate social good with reflected social good. And so creation and generation of new narratives and how we communicate with other people, I think that also is really the part of the words too, you know. So I think the question of language and experience and how intertwined they are, and if we can use that in everyday planning practice, that's something that we don't really usually talk about, I think, in planning academic literature. And so when it comes to then how do we connect that discourse narration to more policy and action, political action, was that I think I mentioned probably in the end bits of the chapter 5 is the power of kind of the cultural movement. And it's almost, I think, now I think about it, I think it's kind of connected to whose culture or, you know, whose way of being or whose knowing really matters in the world. So if someone wants to initiate something new and they want to create some kind of movement, I think there are really just heterogeneous perspectives of being in the world and knowing the world. So that means that there are heterogeneous ways of making culture. So if you can make culture and if you can gain mainstream momentum, I think there can be a pressure on the politicians and pressure on the planning practitioners and the people who make the laws and policies. It kind of becomes this more of a social dialogue. So that's why I'm really interested in how each individual, assuming that everyone has something to contribute, something new, as a person, like a unique person who wants to contribute something new, and how they try to build more popular or more mainstream movement through different kinds of creative means. And if you build that movement, how does it translate? How can that be translated into a political action is something that I'm interested in. Probably in the future, maybe I should work more on it. But for me, at the moment, I was more interested in that the building of cultural kind of the atmospheric approach to environmentalism. I don't know if I making sense.
No, I think that makes sense. I was just going to follow up by asking if you could maybe talk about an example of that you encountered in one of your cities that you were researching. Maybe give us a little more concrete illustration of what that might look like to build that kind of cultural atmosphere or movement around these issues.
Yeah. So I think one of the ways, I think there are three ways. One way is the everyday infrastructure. So, you know, the practitioners in Cape Town and practitioners in Cleveland, they talk a lot about, you know, sewer and stormwater management. So really cities are the intensive, kind of centers of intensive material movements. And they can kind of talk about this basic infrastructure like electricity, wastewater, and sewer systems to highlight how we are dependent on the ecosystem dynamics. So that's one way. And the other way is to talk about like the topological elements that people sense in the everyday urban living, right? I mean, the mountains and rivers and things like that. And as I discussed in the case of Cleveland, is that they had a big kind of art exhibition, and also there was a big art event about Cuyahoga River and celebrating Cuyahoga River. And so they invited this international artist called Chego Chang, and he kind of this performative theatrical event about Cuyahoga lighting and really making people aware how our life or, you know, the living the city is dependent on water and the Cuyahoga River that has been existed for centuries, even before humans, I don't know, human settlement began. And so all those kind of historical elements of topology and mountain water and rivers, hills, and, you know, I kind of talk about that in the gondola system in Medellin, that all of those transportation infrastructure also dependent on the topological background of the city too. So really highlighting that historical relationship between topological elements and human settlement could be also one way. Finally, the other way is really the agency of built environment and design. And this is where I think I'm quite inspired by kind of non-representation theory, like the effect theory, and how like a building and architecture and design that you come across or pass in cities, they can inspire you because it affects your emotion, how you feel, how you perceive you and the surrounding environment. So the agency of buildings and what that makes you feel is also one element for cities to enact on this kind of atmospheric approach to environmentalist imageries.
Okay, so I now want to change gears a little bit and ask you about scale. So, you know, you're obviously not the first person to suggest that cities are a good scale at which to deal with climate change and, you know, all these other issues that get wrapped up under that label of the Anthropocene. But I think one sort of interesting thing that you do is that you reconceptualize the global scale a little bit, so that it's not so much that, you know, if we are thinking at the scale of the city, then we're sort of not being global. We're setting the global part aside. You know, global's too big of a scale to work at. But you kind of connect in the global scale to the urban or city scale. So could you talk a little bit about the importance of scale and, you know, what it means to address these problems at the city scale?
Yeah, I think my interest in the scale itself, it really began with, I think that's a really great question, by the way. I think it really began with, for me, trying to grapple with the ecosystem dynamics. So my background is, hazard mitigation and environmental planning. So I kind of think about what that means in terms of scale. That's kind of the, there's a tree scale, there's a forest scale, there is a, a wider ecosystem scale, that there is a physical element. But what I found out is that there is a whole different literature, a political geography literature, and it talks about the political scales of how intertwined city politicians are influenced by global politics and vice versa. And all of these networks of political scale is there too. And I kind of try to grapple with why would that side of political geography would matter to ecosystem scale, and what ecosystem scale can teach to the political geography understanding of politics of scale. So for me, what was useful from the literature of Latour is that he kind of describes global as globally ubiquitous. So it's not really about global as in the, Archimedean globe that you have on your desk, the globe, but more about the globalness of globalness as ubiquitousness of the things that we interact, like the water, air, all of these things are ubiquitous. Internet, you name it, a lot of things that we share in the world is ubiquitous. And John Dewey also says that, if we think about global problems, we have to start from our own backyard, our own garden. And I think in that understanding of global as ubiquitousness, you can link what's global with local. Local in the sense that you can immediately sense what's going on. You can immediately sense what's going on in your garden, how you're going to plant something, how they're going to grow well. There is the question of care. And then it also matters that experience of caring your backyard can be connected to a wider perception of your responsibility to wider forces or the things that are larger. I think that's kind of the procedural thing. So I think the main argument is that ubiquitousness, how that helps us to understand how local can also be global. But probably what I think what I failed to touch on is really the connection of like the process of building that. I think there is a new discussion right now about what's the geography of a responsibility, responsibility of your own community and your own city, and that really goes to the international too, all of these things that Nancy Fraser talks about of different scales of responsibility. I think that's really up to us to talk about. I think it's a long process of talking about my responsibility to the environment here and now, and the longer term responsibility of us, even as human species, to talk about it. But I don't know, it's a big topic, so I don't think I kind of represent it very well. I don't really know, but I think that thinking of environmental issues as globally ubiquitous, I think it's something that helps us understand why global can be connected with the local. I don't know. Does it make sense? I don't know.
Yeah, and I was actually going to say, you mentioned Latour a couple times in this interview, and I've been kind of a Latour skeptic for a long time, but your book has actually kind of sold me on Latour having some useful things to say. There are a few times when you said something, I was like, oh, that's a really good idea. Oh, hey, you're building on the tour with that. That's interesting. So I might have to go reread his stuff, with a new eye to it after having seen what you do in your book. So,
but I want to mention that Latour really draws a lot from John Dewey. So I think people who are interested in Latour have to read John Dewey to understand more the political, side of ANT. I think that's what I wanted to mention.
Well, so that's actually probably why your book is like selling me on the tour, because I've been a John Dewey fan for a while. And so I think if you're kind of showing the connections between, you know, one of my favorite and one of my least favorite writers. So it's making me reevaluate things a little bit.
That's awesome. Awesome to meet a friend of Dewey.
Okay, so then I also wanted to ask about your process for doing the research for the book. So you did a whole bunch of interviews with planners and activists and other stakeholders in these four cities. So what were some of the challenges and the surprises that you encountered while doing the actual data gathering part of the research?
Yeah, one of the challenges is really up to the people that I meet. Like if I meet someone who is the node of the network, he's going to introduce me, or she or they will introduce me with the bunch of people that they know. So in Tulsa, I kind of, you know, try to contact one person who's a disaster planning expert who's been mentioned in newspapers several times. I try to contact him, and then I try to contact the other person who's more expertise in recycling. And that the recycling person helped me go to different kinds of events. So there are different events that are he was going and that I was invited to, and etc. So I was quite lucky. I think in Darwin, I think it was a bit more challenging because I think people there were trying to appreciate more the you know, I think you know, the local researchers and academics, and which is really, you know, I think that's really important, you know, because I'm transnational visitor, so you know, I'm always aware of that. But I still managed to talk to city personals, and there was one guy who connected me to two or three environmental activists, and that was really useful too. But you know, the all really began from the internet research of finding who seems to be the connection in newspaper articles or the things that are happening. And Cleveland, I was really lucky because I, you know, the same way I kind of contacted different environmental organizations, and one of them got back to me and they invited me to big events on environmentalism. And how that's how I got hooked up with different people. In Cape Town, I just kind of attended one of the research meeting of a different colleague. But he introduced me to one city official, and that person became the node for me because she knew so many people on that environmental planning. So then I got hooked onto this. So I think it's sometimes it often begins with the newspaper article search try to find the person who seems to be the main actor and try to, you know, follow the actors, as Latour says. But in case of, I think Cape Town was more about it was through some connections that my colleague had, and then I kind of built my connections through them. So I think what I really learned from this research is really about how all of this is human connections and interactions in general. You know, like I think I kind of took on a different approach as opposed to other academic research, in that sense that I try to like meet with people who are doing the work, as opposed to, I mean, I there are a lot of academic researchers doing that, but what I meant to say is that, you know, it's not like I'm trying to draw the objective kind of static picture of what was happening. For me, I was just really interested in talking and interacting with the people who was doing the work. And so I think that really made me realize what is important in inquiry. A pragmatist, you know, try to reframe research into social inquiry, because we think that knowledge making is not taking a picture, a static picture of what's going on, but more about interacting with different kinds of people. And that's how you gain the value for your knowledge making. And so I think what really taught me was that I really have to go out in the world more, and my knowledge making should be intertwined with how practitioners do their work. And I think that's something that I don't do, and I think that's something that I should do more. So I think I was guilty of that myself, you know, trying to capture the objective reality. And I tried to move away from that towards more of the engagement with the real world. you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I don't know if I'm making sense.
No, I think that makes perfect sense. And so it's kind of a good segue then into our final question, which is to ask what you're working on next. What kind of projects are you taking up now that this book is out?
Yeah, so I'm really interested in kind of post-Western epistemologies inspired by Anna Ching, you know. So Anna Ching kind of talks about the Western approach to environmentalism, that is kind of the humans are evil, so we have to control their behavior. And she kind of compares that with Japanese Santoyama practice, where the environmentalism is more about finding out what nature or culture through interaction. So the kind of intertwinement of nature and culture and the co-evolution process of, you know, learning and co-inhabiting. So I'm really interested in how this kind of post-Western epistemologies affects how we do contemporary urban research in Global East and Global South. So I'm trying to work with different non-Western urbanists who do the similar work, in the sense that we value local conventions and cultures in studying different regions. And the other work that I'm doing is the relationship between identity and local politics, and where environment sits in between the two. I talk about how, like, problematic situations like waste management or extreme climate events become opportunities for multicultural communities to come out of their ontological bubble by collectively addressing the public issues at hand.
Okay, well, that all sounds really exciting, and we'd love to have you back if you end up writing a book about that stuff. So thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks so much, Stenter.
So you just heard a conversation with Inji John, author of Cities in the Anthropocene, New Ecology and Urban Politics, published this year by Pluto Press.